In the spirit of Crazy Horse, in the spirit of Medicom, in the spirit of Geronimo, above all, to all people who fight and struggle for real justice, we are not vanishing, we are not conquered, we are as strong as ever.
November 25th was the observance of the National Day of Mourning, which takes place on the fourth Thursday of November every year. It's also known as the historical myth Thanksgiving.
This is our warrior cry to the world. We are not drowning, we are fighting.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates. I'm your host, Jacqueline Batisse.
To our elders who teach us of our creation and our past, so we may preserve Mother Earth for ancestors yet to come, we are the land.
This is dedicated to our relatives before us, thousands of years ago, and to the 150 million who were exterminated across the Western Hemisphere in the first 400 years' time, starting in 1492.
To those who have kept their homelands, and to the nations extinct due to mass slaughter, slavery, deportation, and disease unknown to them, and to the ones who are subjected to the same treatment today, to the ones who survived the relocations and the ones who died along the way, to those who carried on traditions and lived strong among their people, to those who left their communities by force or by choice and through generations no longer know who they are.
To those who search and never find, to those that turn away the so-called non-accepted, to those that bring us together, and to those living outside, keep in touch.
The National Day of Mourning honors Indigenous ancestors and Native resilience. It is a day of remembrance and of spiritual connection, as well as protests against the continued oppression and injustices Indigenous people experience worldwide by systems of colonization and white supremacy. Matawin Monroe is a Lakota woman who has been a longtime organizer with the National Day of Mourning from its beginning and is a leader with the United American Indians of New England. She emceed the event and posted this on her social media. We had a powerful National Day of Mourning with well over 1,000 people in attendance. This year, the torch was passed to the young organizers, including Keisha James, a Wampanoan youth organizer for United American Indians of New England. Speakers represented the diversity of Indigenous nations, including a message from the Council of Mayan Elders and people from the Arawak, Taino, the Mexica, and Wampanoag nations, including a message from political prisoner Leonard Peltier. Here's Keisha James.
The pilgrims came here as part of a commercial venture. They didn't need religious freedom. They already had that back in the Netherlands. The Mayflower Compact was merely a group of white men who wanted to ensure they would get a return on their investment. When the pilgrims arrived, on Outer Cape Cod, by the way, not on that pebble down the hill, one of the first things the pilgrims did was to rob Wampanoag graves at Corn Hill and steal as much of their winter provisions of corn and beans as they were able to carry. The writings of the colonists themselves describe these actions taking place. The next part of the mythology is true. Some Wampanoag ancestors did welcome the pilgrims and save them from starvation. And what did we get in return for this kindness? Genocide, the theft of our lands, slavery, starvation, and never-ending oppression. It is also important to remember that the first official Thanksgiving did not take place in 1621, when the pilgrims had a harvest time meal provided largely by the Wampanoag. Instead, the first Thanksgiving was declared in 1637 by Governor Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony to celebrate the massacre of over 700 Pequot men, women, and children on the banks of the Mystic River in Connecticut. William Bradford of the Plymouth Colony wrote of this event, "Those that escaped the fire were slain with the sword, some hewed to pieces, others run through with their rapiers. They thus destroyed 400 at this time. It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire. Horrible was the stink and scent thereof, but the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they gave the prayers thereof to God, who had wrought so wonderfully for them this victory. Subsequent slaughters of indigenous people would be celebrated by a day of thanksgiving, and yet the history books call us the savages. So why does any of this matter? It is simple. When people perpetuate the myth of Thanksgiving, they are not only erasing our genocide, but also celebrating it. We did not simply fade into the background, as the Thanksgiving myth says. We have survived and thrived. We have persevered. The very fact that you are here is proof that we did not vanish. Our very presence frees this land from the lies of the history books and the myth makers. We will remember and honor all our ancestors in the struggle who went before us. We will speak truth to power as we have been doing since the first day of mourning in 1970. That first day of mourning in 1970 was a powerful demonstration of Native unity. It has continued for all these years as a powerful demonstration of unity and the unity of all people who speak truth to power. Sadly, many of the conditions that prevailed in Indian country in 1970 still prevail today. In 1970, our average life expectancy was just 44 years. Today it is up, but for Native men, it is still 6 years below that of white people. Native women's death rate has increased 20% over the past 15 years. In 1970, the average Native yearly income was $4,347. In 2019, 20% of Native people still earned under $5,000. In 1970, our suicide and infant mortality rates were among the highest in the country, and this has not changed. We all know that racism is alive and well. All of us are struggling under the oppression of a capitalist system which forces people to make a bitter choice between heating and eating. We will continue to gather on this hill until corporations and the U.S. military stop polluting the earth. Until we dismantle the brutal apparatus of mass incarceration. We will not stop until the oppression of our two spirit siblings is a thing of the past. When the freedmen are granted equal rights by the so-called five civilized tribes who enslaved their ancestors, when unhoused people have homes, when children are no longer taken from their parents and locked in cages at the border, when the Palestinians reclaim the homeland and the autonomy Israel has denied them for the past 70 years, when no person goes hungry or is left to die because they have little or no access to quality health care, when insulin is free, when union busting is a thing of the past, until then, the struggle will continue. In 1970, we demanded an end to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It is still a demand today. Native nations should not need federal oversight to govern ourselves or take control of our own lands. As we did in 1970, we mourn the loss of millions of our ancestors and the devastation of the land, water, and air. We condemn all acts of violence and terrorism perpetuated by all governments and organizations against innocent people worldwide. Since the invasion of Columbus and the rest of the Europeans, Native people have been virtually non-stop victims of terrorism. From the colonial period to the 21st century, this has entailed torture, massacres, systematic military occupations, and the forced removals of indigenous peoples from their homelands. Let us not forget that this country was founded on the ideology of white supremacy, the widespread practice of African slavery, and a policy of genocide and land theft. Let us not forget that under the pipelines, skyscrapers, mines, and oil rigs lie the interred bones, sacred objects, and villages of our Native ancestors. On our program will be only Indigenous speakers. This is one day when we speak for ourselves without non-Native people, so-called experts, intervening to interpret and speak for us. Today, on liberated territory, we will correct the history of a country that continues to glorify butchers such as Christopher Columbus, that makes slave-owning presidents such as Washington and Jefferson into godlike figures, and even carves their faces into the sacred black hills of the Lakota. In 1970, very few people would have given any thought to the fact that the indigenous people of this hemisphere do not look upon the arrival of the European invaders as a reason to give thanks. Today, many thousands stand with us in spirit as we commemorate the 2021 National Day of Mourning. As my grandfather said back in 1970, we are now being heard. We are now being listened to. The important point is we still have the spirit. We still have the unique culture. We still have the will and, most important of all, the determination to remain as Indians. We are determined, and our presence here is living testimony that this is only the beginning of the American Indian, particularly the Wampanoag, to regain the position in this country that is rightfully ours. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, in the spirit of Metacom, in the spirit of Geronimo, above all, to all people who fight and struggle for real justice, we are not vanishing, we are not conquered, we are as strong as ever.
Keisha James, the granddaughter of Moomin James, one of the founding members of the National Day of Mourning, who joined the Land of the Ancestors last year in December.
A stolen native land! No! Pipelines! A stolen native land!
For several years, the Wet'suwet'en Nation, under the leadership of the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs of all five of their clans, have been protecting their traditional homeland from Coastal GasLink's effort to drill a tunnel for their $6.6 billion pipeline. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police descended on the resistance camp this past week and arrested 30 people, including Indigenous elders and two journalists. Here is Slado, who was there when it was all going down.
This is Slado. We're here on Cassia Yinta. The RCMP have moved in this morning on Gidimden checkpoint. CGL is enforcing their own injunction order. They started this morning on both ends of the blockade at 63 with a bunch of heavy machinery. Dozers were chasing somebody with a dozer. They had rock trucks. Currently, right now, the state of Gidimden checkpoint is that dozers have rolled in, heavy machinery, CGL workers, and RCMP. And we just got word that they released K-9 units at the bridge at Gidimden checkpoint. Our warriors are down there. Our matriarch is there. There's a lot of people that are there that are at risk of this police violence. We need everybody to have ears to the ground, eyes on what's happening here. There was another plane load of RCMP that just landed in Smithers this morning, and they're headed out to the territory. They came out last night in bus loads. With skidoos and with quads, and they're advancing on both ends of the blockade currently. We're defending this space as best as we can. The warriors down at Gidimden checkpoint are defending that space as best as they can. They're sent the attack dogs, the canine units in on them, and we have no word yet of what's happening. They read the injunction to everybody there and said that those people are under arrest for impeding the Supreme Court injunction. Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs and our clans have full jurisdiction here. They have no right to be on our territory. They have no right to be bringing canine units into our unarmed people that are defending this land and upholding Wet'suwet'en law. They are trespassing, they are violating human rights, they are violating Indigenous rights, and most importantly, they are violating Wet'suwet'en law. We need boots on the ground, we need everybody out there, we need everybody who's an ally of Wet'suwet'en, of Haudenosaunee, a supporter of Indigenous rights, a supporter and a warrior of climate justice, to take action now, to show this industry, this government, and the world that they cannot do this to Indigenous people anymore.
It's the third year in a row that the RCMP have enforced injunctions on the Wet'suwet'en using militarized force. That was Slado speaking. Brianna Fruin, a Samoan climate justice activist and member of the Pacific Climate Warriors delegation at the COP26, speaks at the UN Climate Convention in Glasgow, Scotland, that took place on October 31st to November 13th.
When I was a little girl, I was taught the importance and impact of words. In my culture, in Samoa, there's a proverb that goes, "E pala ma'a, aile pala upu." It means that even stones decay, but words remain. A lesson in knowing how words can be wielded, how text can change everything, how each word you use is weighted, how switching one word or number could reframe worlds, how climate action can be vastly different from climate justice, how 2 degrees could mean the end, and 1.5 could mean a fighting chance. You all have the power here today to be better, to remember that in your meeting rooms and drafting documents are more than just black and white objects, to remember that in your words you wield the weapons that can save us or sell us out. I don't need to remind you the reality of vulnerable communities. If you're here today, you know what climate change is doing to us. You don't need my pain or my tears to know that we're in a crisis. The real question is whether you have the political will to do the right thing, to wield the right words, and to follow it up with long overdue action. If you're looking for inspiration on this, look no further than the climate leadership of young Pacific people. We are not just victims to this crisis. We have been resilient beacons of hope. Pacific youth have rallied behind the cry, "We are not drowning, we are fighting." This is our warrior cry to the world. We are not drowning, we are fighting. This is my message from Earth to COP. I hope you remember my words today and look closely at your words as you go throughout COP, because e pala ma'a aile pala upu. Thank you.
Samoa climate justice activist Brianna Fruin, speaking at the COP26 on the power of words, as she says, "We are not drowning, we are fighting." The song Pemin by Not Drowning Waving. This is COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Jacqueline Batiste. On Saturday, November 20, Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland visited Alcatraz Island in San Francisco on the 52nd anniversary of its occupation by indigenous people, Indians of all tribes. The takeover that took place in 1969 lasted 14 months and ended when the indigenous people were forced to leave by the federal government. Indians of all tribes claimed the island by citing the Treaty of Fort Laramie of 1868 between the U.S. and the Lakota. Here is Secretary Holland as heard on Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein.
Thank you all so much. I'm really happy to be here, and a beautiful, beautiful day on the ancestral lands of the Ohlone people. Gwatsi Haupa, greetings everyone. Duhiname Itzatuwitsa Shui Mihanu. I'm honored to speak today from Alcatraz Island. Like many of the public lands in the care of the Department of the Interior, these lands tell a story, and you can feel it. Some may think Alcatraz Island as a place that movies and novels have described, where prisoners were kept in cells and tried to escape. But for me and for many Indigenous people, this land tells another story. In November of 1969, I was almost 9 years old. I didn't understand it then, but my very existence as a Native child was in some ways an act of defiance against historic policies to exterminate Indigenous cultures, traditions, languages, and essentially us as a group of people. We are the descendants of ancestors who lived in tune with nature, practiced sustainability, and thrived on this continent long before the colonization of North America. Many of us are the descendants of people who endured horrific brutality at the hands of those who oppressed us. We are the descendants of grandparents, aunts, uncles, and parents who were stolen from their homes and from their families so that their cultures, traditions, and languages could be wiped away from their memories. Many of us come from families who were relocated from our homelands with broken promises by the federal government that their children would have better lives. In November of 1969, a history began with acts of defiance to take the rock. That history, in many ways, paved the way for tribal self-determination policies that President Biden and I championed just this week as we gathered with tribal leaders for the first White House Tribal Nations Summit of this administration. 52 years ago, the situation was dire. The federal government had walked away from their promises to help Indigenous people who were forced to relocate to urban areas. Federal agencies refused to abide by basic consultation standards, and many Native communities had lost large swaths of their lands. When Indigenous people are separated from their homelands, from our traditions, and from our people, the impacts are more than physical. They're spiritual. They manifest deep in our bodies, in our hearts, and have lasting intergenerational consequences. I remember reading countless stories of young Indigenous mothers who couldn't get housing or food for their children, Indigenous students facing discrimination at school, and terrible abuse of Indigenous people on the streets of many American cities. It harkens back to the memories of other kids making fun of my braids or my dark skin when I was a little girl. I never told my mother about these things. I didn't know it then, but I felt ashamed. So many of us did, and we didn't have the words to describe it. It's a feeling that tears at our souls and is in direct opposition to who we are as people. We cultivate community. We care for our environment. We help each other. We crave connection to our ancestors. We love the earth. The occupation of Alcatraz Island by Indigenous people in 1969 was more than a call for action. It was a cry for a sense of community and the lifeways that were stolen from us. Alcatraz was born out of desperation. Out of this, we gained a sense of community and visibility in the eyes of the federal government. But more than that, our Indigenous identities were somehow restored. Many people romanticize the occupation of Alcatraz, but we cannot overlook the hardships that families endured over those 2 years. But because of the sacrifices that were made in this place, we no longer have to act out of desperation. The fact that I'm standing here today is a testament to that fact. I am here. We are here. And we're not going anywhere. We're in a new era. We're in a new era, an era in which we can embrace our identities as Indigenous people and be proud of how much we have accomplished. An era of real opportunities to engage with the federal government, in which the President of the United States gathers tribal leaders together for a White House Tribal Nations Summit so that the policies we create reflect the needs of tribes, so that tribal leaders have a real seat at the table before decisions are made that impact their communities. An era in which we recognize the value of traditional Indigenous knowledge in our efforts to address the climate crisis. An era in which our commitment to Native American, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, and island communities is reflected in an all-of-government approach to address the needs of Indigenous people. It's that commitment that drives the work we do at the Department of the Interior. Whether it's restoring tribal homelands and empowering tribes to make decisions for their communities, or putting the power of the federal government behind the work to address the missing and murdered Indigenous peoples crisis, and the intensive process we are undertaking to heal from the terrible impacts that Indian boarding schools have had on our communities. We are centering Indigenous voices in all of our work. Because we are still here.
Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland. Originally, Indigenous affairs were governed by the Department of War.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Bernadette Dementev, Executive Director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee to the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Natural Resources. Here is Bernadette in conversation with Code Pink Radio.
You know, I'm grateful that we have an administration that is actually respecting, you know, some of our ways that we... This is not just the Gwich'in issue. This is... and everybody issue. Climate change, don't care what color you are, don't care if you're black, white, brown, don't care if you're rich or poor. We are all going to be negatively impacted. And it's time that we start sticking our differences aside and come together and start working together, especially if we love our children. We need to do better. If we don't have a government that supports that, then we need to do it together. We're stronger together. I just want to, you know, share that every 2 years, the Gwich'in Nation, it's consists of Alaska and Canada. They stuck border right in the middle of our homelands. We come together to reaffirm our commitment to protect the Jikwats and Gundaigotlit. We haven't had that because of the COVID that's been passing around, and it's impacting a lot of our communities right now up here. We have a really high rate of COVID patients, and it's hard to see the world as it is now and wondering if it's going to stay like this for the rest of the time, because climate change ain't slowing down. You can't stop it. I mean, we can do stuff to prevent it, to, you know, slow it down, prepare our children, but it's here, and it's time we accept that. I'm a strong believer in the power of prayer. I just hope that we can find a way to unite and, you know, save Mother Earth, save what we have left.
Thank you so much, Bernadette. It's so moving to listen to you. Like you said, we're all in this together. Now, I know that Biden imposed, through executive order, a temporary moratorium on oil and gas drilling in the Arctic. Do you find that your U.S. senators from Alaska are advocates for you as Republicans? How does that work?
Absolutely not. They do not interact with the Indigenous people up there. When voting comes around, they do. I'm just being honest. I'm trying to choose my words carefully so I don't, I'm not being disrespectful in any way. You know, our elders told us to three directions is go out and tell the world we are here to work in a good way and not to compromise our position. So that do it in a good way is a very simple sentence, but when you're up against so much dishonesty and misleading statements from our own elected leadership, it's not always easy. They have been, Murkowski's father, who was in her seat prior to her being senator, he always tried to have it opened. This is the last remaining 5% up here. You know, this is the rest of on this side of Alaska is open. And all the caribou herds that are in that area have declined. One of them have declined 57% since 2010. They can't tell us that our food security and our way of life will not be impacted, not clearly see different. So we have been up against our own administration, Alaska administration, going down, having to ask other senators for help because ours refused to listen.
Many challenges ahead. Thank you so much, Bernadette. Great honor to have you with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Code Pink Radio featuring Gwich'in leader Bernadette Dementev. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a political prisoner, award-winning journalist, and author of 6 books. Here is his commentary from Prison Radio on Thanksgiving and Leonard Peltier.
As I let my mind wander beyond the steel bars and concrete walls, I try to imagine what the people who live outside the prison gates are doing and what they're thinking. Do they ever think of the indigenous people who were forced from their homelands? Do they understand that with every step they take, no matter the direction, that they are walking on stolen land? Can they imagine, even for 1 minute, what it was like to watch the suffering of the women, the children, and babies, and yes, the sick and elderly, as they were made to keep pushing west in freezing temperatures with little or no food? These were my people, and this was our land. There was a time when we enjoyed freedom and were able to hunt buffalo and gather the foods and sacred medicines. We were able to fish, and we enjoyed the clean, clear water. My people were generous. We shared everything we had, including the knowledge of how to survive the long, harsh winters or the hot, humid summers. We were appreciative of the gifts from our Creator and remembered to give thanks on a daily basis. We had ceremonies and special dances that were a celebration of life. With the coming of foreigners to our shores, life, as we knew it, would change drastically. Individual ownership was foreign to my people. Fences, unheard of back then. We were a communal people, and we took care of each other. Our grandparents weren't isolated from us. They were the wisdom keepers and storytellers, and were an important link in our families. The babies? They were and are our future. Look at the brilliant young people who put themselves at risk, fighting to keep our water and environment clean and safe for the generations yet to come. They're willing to confront the giant multinational corporations by educating the general public of the devastation being caused. I smile with hope when I think of them. They're fearless and ready to speak the truth to all who are willing to listen. We also remember our brothers and sisters of Bolivia who are rioting in support of the first indigenous president, Evo Morales. His commitment to the people, the land, their resources, and protection against corruption is commendable. We recognize and identify with that struggle so well. So today, I thank all the people who are willing to have an open mind, those who are willing to accept the responsibility of planning for seven generations ahead, those who remember the sacrifices made by our ancestors so we can continue to speak our own language, practice our own way of thankfulness in our own skin, and that we always acknowledge and respect the indigenous lineage that we carry. For those of you who are thankful, you have enough food to feed your families. Please give to those who aren't as fortunate. If you're warm and have a comfortable shelter to live in, please give to those who are cold and homeless. If you see someone hurting and in need of a kind word or two, be that person who steps forward and lends a hand. And especially when you see injustice anywhere, please be brave enough to speak up to confront it. I want to thank all those who are kind enough to remember me and my family in your thoughts and prayers. Thank you for continuing to support and believe in me. There isn't a minute in any day that passes without me hoping that this will be the day I will be granted freedom. I long for the day when I can smell clean, fresh air, when I can feel a gentle breeze in my hair, witness the clouds as their movement hides the sun, and when the moon shines the light on the path to the sacred Inipi. That would truly be a day I could call a day of thanksgiving. Thank you for listening. My spirit is there with you, Duksha. In the spirit of Crazy Horse, you have been listening to the words of Leonard Peltier. It has been my pleasure to share them with you. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Traditional song from Song of the Indian Flute. This is COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Jacqueline Batisse. From Decolonization to Liberation, Lawrence Reyes in conversation with Lenny Foster, Danae Elder, spiritual advisor to American Indian Movement, political prisoner Leonard Peltier. Len Foster has brought traditional spiritual nourishment to incarcerated indigenous people for decades. Now retired, Lenny has an update on the campaign to free Leonard Peltier.
He can't alone here, wait alone, Eddie Conda with the Bedeed no, but Benosh no, but Satis and E with Audi Con, and Jensen Ardis and my relations. I said this prayer in my Dene language. It's a blessing way prayer for all of us. Said a special prayer for all those that are listening. And plus, I remembered our brother Leonard Peltier. He's been in the Federal Bureau of Prison for going on 45, almost 46 years. So we remember him through this prayer. And I became acquainted with him in Denver, Colorado, when I first met him 51 years ago, 1970. That's how long I've known him. And I've sundanced with him at Crow Dog's Paradise in Rosebud, South Dakota, 1975, and that's 46 years ago. So it's been a while. Our friendship, relationship as a spiritual leader, spiritual advisor, sun dancers, pipe keeper, sweat lodge participation has been a long time, and he's been locked up for going on 46 years. So we're engaged in this very extensive campaign to get him released on executive clemency. And so there's a support a group headed by Carol Goki, who's a Ho-Chunk or Winnebago from Wisconsin. We have an attorney, Kevin Sharp, who is working very hard on his effort to be granted executive clemency. And we've had over 90 Congress people who have written, signed on to a letter that was circulated by Congressman Raul Grijalva from Arizona that is being submitted to President Biden's administration and his desk. And also we've had a recent development regarding Native state legislatures that have submitted a resolution requesting release for Leonard Peltier and executive clemency, a compassionate release based on his ill health. He's not doing so well, so we want to continue to fight for his release on executive clemency. Another recent development is the letter that was written, submitted by a former U.S. Prosecutor, attorney, James Reynolds, who was the prosecuting attorney in his trial, and he has submitted a letter requesting clemency for Leonard Peltier because of the many errors that were made in his trial, constitution violations that were committed by the prosecutors in this trial. So the truth is coming out. The truth is coming out. You mentioned decolonization, effort that's going on. One good example is that this coming week is Thanksgiving, but we as Indigenous people, Native Americans, don't recognize that holiday. Actually, it's been a day of mourning that we observe for the atrocities and the genocide that take place as a result of these colonizers coming to our part of the world, the Western Turtle Island. So that we recognize that now. It's a whole movement that began with the American Indian movement. As Lawrence mentioned, that I first joined the American Indian movement, the Indian rights movement in Denver, Colorado, 1970. So I've been with the movement for 51 years, a long time, but it's been worth it because it's changed my life. And many, many of our Indian people have joined this Indian rights movement, Indigenous rights movement. And the International Indian Treaty Council has also taken a major role in advocating for the freedom and awareness. Every efforts have been made to raise the consciousness and to decolonize our lives. And so this movement, this whole worldwide movement, began at 1973 in Wounded Knee, South Dakota. And the indigenous people from Australia, from New Zealand, from Hawaii, South Pacific, South America, Central America, Mexico, Canada, Alaska, and it's even reached parts of Europe, Africa, where indigenous people are recognizing that we can no longer recognize the colonization that has taken place, the brainwashing that has taking place, the genocidal practices that took place. So it's a worldwide movement, and it's good to see that indigenous peoples played a major role in this effort. I want to say thank you for inviting me. Earlier, I introduced myself by my clan. I'm a Taranaus clan, born from Mountain Cove. My maternal grandparents are River Edge, and my paternal grandparents are a nomad, one who walks around. So that's how we return to those ways, to those teachings, how we introduce ourselves and recognize each other in that manner. We're told by our teachings that you introduce yourself in a proper manner where the spirits can also recognize you. That's how I introduce myself. And that prayer was a blessing way prayer I've used that's taken me throughout this world. And I prayed for our good health. And that's what we are thankful for. We're grateful for our health and our presence, our relatives, our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And that we're able to spend time in those ways with our family and enjoy each other's company. That's gratefulness that we have towards one another at this time. Like the white man calls Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Uncle Lenny Foster, for your words and your prayers. And they will sustain the people.
Lawrence Reyes with Lenny Foster of the American Indian Movement, Dene Elder, and spiritual advisor to longtime friend Leonard Peltier. You can hear more of the interview from Decolonization to Liberation on www.radiojustice.org. The following is from a video produced by former Franciscan friar Jack Healy, who once headed Amnesty International USA. It is a plea for a compassionate release for Leonard Peltier, who is now 77 years old and in failing health. Peltier was convicted of murder after a shootout occurred with FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. Amnesty International has always contended that he was unfairly convicted because of fabricated affidavits, withheld exculpatory evidence, and other prosecutorial misconduct. Peltier has been in prison for 46 years. The narrator is Maggie Q, martial artist and actress.
There are multiple doors for freedom for the incarcerated. Compassionate release is where justice meets mercy. Often thought of as a passive choice, words like mercy and compassion, but that's not the case. They are the foundation of most religions. Many say the legal system has already made a choice in this, and I don't want to interfere. But you must, for you're also part of the justice system. You've always been a part of it, and you changed the life of this one prisoner by asking for mercy for him, for asking for compassion. It is not passive, it is bold, and when you do so, you become part of the justice system. It was designed to include mercy and compassion. It was designed to include you. It's calling for compassionate release.
I think of him often and pray that he will be allowed to go home at last.
Help bring Leonard Peltier home.
And I hope that you find it in your heart to do so.
Please send Leonard home.
This is a time we can stand together. I will ask for it. Will you?
I will.
I will.
I will ask. Will you?
I will.
I will.
I will. Will you?
I will.
I will.
I will. I will.
Ask for freedom today for aging prisoner, Native American Leonard Peltier. He has served his time, over 45 years, and is in ill health. He is over 2,000 miles away from family and homeland at Turtle Mountain, North Dakota. Please, free him.
I will continue to add my voice to theirs in asking the President of the United States to join us in ending his long struggle. I am saddened when I think of his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren living all these years without him in their lives.
Thomas Aquinas said, "Justice without mercy is cruelty." Lend your voice to ours and ask for compassion and mercy for Leonard Peltier. I will ask. Will you?
Some of the voices featured were Harry Belafonte, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Irene Bedard, Lenny Foster, and Maggie Q narrating. Deb Holland, Secretary of the Interior, co-drafted a clemency appeal in 2020 and has updated it, and it's now before President Biden, and was signed by 12 members of Congress. Many indigenous people refused to celebrate the arrival of pilgrims and other European settlers. Thanksgiving Day is a day gobbled up by the turkeys, perpetuating the myth. Do not celebrate the genocide of millions of indigenous people. The past is more than a memory, said John Trudell. This program is dedicated to Mu'nanim James, Burt Waters, and all the people, all the relatives who have suffered and survived and who have returned to the land of the ancestors. We honor our ancestors together. We take this moment to honor the ancestors.
Hi, on this maki, nukspumus na tuaki, nukspumus a punokae kukan, nukspumus a natus, spumata piaki, mistaki wuta.
That concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of the Pacifica sister stations and radio affiliates who contributed to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by KPFT's Jacqueline Batiste and Akua Holt, editing by Polina Vasilev. Executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasilev, and Steve Zeltzer. And special thanks to Thunderheart Films for music from the film Inishkin. You can find this and all previous episodes online at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Jacqueline Batiste. Thanks for listening.